In this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, EVGA's RTX 2060, AMD's Radeon 7 28-core Beast chips, and Snapdragon Yoga. It's going to get freaky in here. Next. Welcome back to another episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks. I'm Dave Altavilla, and I am joined this week. We are going it with just two geeks. So hopefully you guys can handle that. I'm joined this week, as always, it seems, with the illustrious and ever fabulous Marco Cipetta. How are you today there, buddy?
I'm doing okay. It was a busy week getting ready for the Radeon 7 launch that happened this morning, but it's done. I could take a deep breath and things are all good.
Things are all good. Are you feeling fresh and you got your Radeon, dude?
Not feeling fresh. This old guy never feels fresh anymore. But I'm happy that one's off my plate. I tried to do a fair amount of testing to cover compute, games, synthetics, yada yada yada, power, overclocking, at least what overclocking could be done. And I think we tell a good story with that card. I think the review came out okay.
Cool. Telling stories. Well, we'll get to that for sure in short order. Lots going on right about now. We are rolling up to, it seems like it's Q1. It's just one thing into another. We are rolling up to Mobile World Congress, fresh off of CES 2019 in Las Vegas, Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. We're not going to be there, actually. We will be covering. There's lots of announcements. I am going out to Samsung Unpacked, which is a known event going on in San Francisco right around the, 19th, I think. Yeah. At any rate, and that's, again, the buildup to Mobile World Congress. So lots of things going on in the mobile world, lots of things going on in the desktop computing space. Just really bubbling right about now as we, it's like we rolled out of CES, everybody announced and unveiled, and now it's time to execute and ship. So. What are you most excited about, Marco, beyond the PC space? Anything that's caught your eye lately? Because there's a lot bubbling in the tech before we dig into the particulars here.
And nothing terribly exciting outside of the PC space for me. It seems like lots of incremental upgrades coming in the ultra mobile, smartphone space. Tablets to me are kind of dead. There's no point when you can get an awesome convertible, like the Yoga we're going to be talking about in a bit. I think for me, the most exciting stuff, which has been for the last, 30 years for me, is the enthusiast computing stuff. And there has been a lot of really cool enthusiast stuff happening recently, which I think is great.
Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. I'm a little bit more excited in the mobile space. I gravitate a little bit more than you do towards the handset side of what we do. Although PC is near and dear to my heart, of course, as well. I'm excited to see what these next generation of phones come to the table with. When you talk about new platforms like Snapdragon 855, different 5G, 5G platforms from Qualcomm as well, that will enable new technologies, and then some of the new design iterations that hopefully will be either doing away with the notch or other integration levels of integration like fingerprint readers in glass and stuff like that. So I think we're cooking up for some good stuff all over the tech space in the weeks ahead here. And why don't we dig into the headlines now and talk about what's been going on at Hot Hardware the last week or so and what folks have to look forward to as some of these products hit the market. Hey, by the way, Patriots, Super Bowl world champions yet again. Sorry, but we're still here. I had to say that. I hail from Boston. Marco doesn't care because he doesn't track football, right, Marco? You could not care.
I could not care less. The Super Bowl was an excuse to have a party. It was the first game I watched all season. My daughter was rooting for the Patriots. She picked the Patriots, so she was happy. But yeah, all I care about is boxing, man. You know me.
I knew I liked that kid for a reason. I didn't know why, but now I know. She's a Patriots fan. That's a beautiful thing. But all right, well, good stuff. Well, we won't bore anybody anymore because the Super Bowl was a little bit of a snooze fest until about the fourth quarter anyways. But Yeah, let's dig right in and talk about something you looked at, Marco. Before we get into what folks may be looking at as the main event here for the podcast, AMD's Radeon 7, but let's talk about a few other things. EVGA's GeForce RTX 2060 XC review, compact and overclocked. There it is there. That's the GeForce RTX 2080 XC from EVGA. It's a short little stubby fella now, isn't it? And it's got a beefy cooler on it, though. What is this card all about? And I guess what's the value prop here?
Yeah, so it is exactly sort of what you mentioned. It's a short, stout GeForce RTX 2060. So EVGA for the Turing release has really gone nuts. Like, they have a ton of cards at multiple form factors, liquid cooled, air cooled, multi-fan, single fan. Like, you name a card style, EVGA has come out with it. This particular RTX 2060 is a factory overclocked 2060, which is to say it's faster than NVIDIA's reference design. But instead of using the 9.5-inch PCB like NVIDIA's card, this guy's got a 7.5-inch PCB, slightly higher GPU clocks, and instead of making the cooler longer, it's thicker. So this guy's, you know, a 2¾ slot, effectively 3-slot wide 2060, but nice and cool. Outperformed NVIDIA's reference card across the board because of this one's higher GPU boost frequency. This one can boost up to 1755 megahertz, whereas NVIDIA's card boosts to 1680 megahertz. And yeah, overall, just a strong RTX 2060, only $10 more for the smaller form factor and the slightly higher clocks. The one thing that might surprise some people that are fans of EVGA stuff, there is no RGB on the 2060 line. So that logo along the top, none of that stuff is lighted on this card. It's just a straight up cooler in the same style as some of EVGA's other offerings, but no lighting on this guy. But yeah, you know, cutting edge, relatively affordable, $359 RTX 2060. With decent performance. You know, you're talking basically 1080 level performance. And just a really nice offering from EVGA, especially if you want something short and stout that would fit in, say, in some micro ATX builds, whereas a full-length card would not.
$359. So your opinion, in the graphics space right now, $350 range. Would you suggest that the RTX 2060 in general is one of the best buys out there? Or I guess, what are your thoughts in terms of price, performance, and features and all that good stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're spending $350 on a GPU right now, the 2060 is the card to get. For some reason, 1080 and 1070 prices have gone buck wild, I'm assuming because supply is dwindling. So in this price range, it's not only arguably the best performer, but you have that, you know, semi future proof feature set. The only drawback is the 6 gig frame buffer versus, say, an 8 gig frame buffer on a 1080. But if you're not gaming at 4K, if you're at, you know, 1440p and below, the six gig should be fine.
Yeah, you know, and actually, if you think about it, that was obviously a cost saving measure for NVIDIA. And this is a big honking GPU, obviously. Turing is a much bigger piece of silicon than the previous generation. So they peeled back 2 gigs of GDDR6 on this card from like a 2070 config or a 2080 config. You're not going to be, you know, with a 2060, you know, even if you had that extra frame buffer, could you hit 4K at playable frame rates anyways?
I mean, in some games, if you look at, you know, some older DX11 titles, some less taxing DX12 titles, if you slightly, you know, dial down the image quality, like, for example, if you look at a game like F1 2018, you know, I don't have let me go to my Radeon review because I do have a 4K number there. So if you look at 4K performance with a 2060 in a game like that, it hits, where did the 2060 hit? It hit 40 frames per second at the absolute highest quality the game has to offer. It actually higher than the highest presets. I also turned on the SSRT shadows. So yeah, you know, with some games, just slightly turn down the image quality. If it's not one of the most demanding titles, you can be playable at 4K. This card's not really designed for 4K. But you can do it if you want to. This is really the 1080p, 1440p, you know, semi-mainstream proposition. I hesitate to call a $360 card mainstream, but it's at least affordable for many gamers.
Yeah, that's what struck me, is that that seemed like the right compromise. If they were had to compromise based on cost, because again, that GPU is more expensive to manufacture. It's a bigger slice of silicon. That made sense, because you're not going to be gaming at 4K as much with this card. It's more of a 1440p and under card. You do get the benefits of all the the different features of Turing and all that good stuff. But yeah, it seems like it's better optimized from a cost standpoint, without that extra frame buffer. And so therefore, that made sense in terms of a trade-off. One thing that occurs to me with the EVGA card now is it's a triple slot solution, right?
Yes, this one's triple slot. 2.75 slots, but that's effectively three slots.
Yeah. So when you look at that versus the Founder Edition cards, 2060 cards, that's you're giving up some length, or you're gaining some length, but giving up some width and slot consumption, right?
Correct. Yep. Shorter PCB, yeah. but thicker when it's installed.
Yeah. So that's the trade-off to make. And to think about as well. I mean, certainly it enables it probably into smaller form factor chassis as a result of that, right? But you're gonna eat another slot, I guess.
Yeah, there's so few people are filling up their slots anymore. Back in the early days of enthusiast computing, it was common for guys to fill every drive bay and have multiple optical drives and try to cram sound card, multiple GPUs, a SCSI card, a TV tuner. We had all this crap in the systems that no one really uses anymore. So it's common for a gaming PC for the only card to be a GPU. So I'm not necessarily a fan of the triple slot cards, but it is what it is. Most people aren't really going to have to give up the ability to expand their system if they sacrifice those two slots.
Yeah. I'll drop a link in the chat here for anybody that happens to be stopping by. There it is. Check out the review. And what would you think would be the nearest competitor from AMD in this bracket price wise that could be an alternate? I mean, would you suggest anything like a Vega 56 or something like this at this point?
So Vega 64s, the prices have really shot down. You can find Vega 64s for right around this price, maybe a little bit more. It's Vega 64 is not as fast. You don't have the RTX support. That said, Vega does have better compute, more frame buffer memory. So, I mean, if you're an AMD fan and you don't care about DLSS and are willing to wait out their ray tracing thing, because there's really only a couple of games that do it right now, a Vega 64 is a perfectly viable option. It's also going to consume more power, but I think most enthusiasts don't care as long as the card is quiet, and you can get quiet, third-party Vega 64s.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, let's move on to something that you and I have been kicking around actually together with Rod on our team, Rod Scherer, who took a look at the Lenovo Yoga C630. We're going to go to laptops now, and then we'll come back to graphics cards. Honest, folks, we'll come back to the gaming PC worlds shortly. But there it is, the Lenovo Yoga C630. Big battery life, always connected. This is an interesting machine. It is not powered by an Intel processor. It's powered by Qualcomm's Snapdragon 850 processor, a mobile platform, which is really, for all intents and purposes, an optimized, amped up version of the Snapdragon 845. And 4 to 8 gigs of RAM, support for SSDs. So I think on board was something like a 128 or a 256 gig SSD on board. 13.3-inch machine, weighs under 2.5 pounds, and Adreno 630 graphics, Qualcomm's Adreno 630 graphics on board. And the nice thing about it, in addition to a 60-watt-hour battery with this essentially, hypermobile quasi-smartphone platform, has a 60-watt-hour battery. It also has what I would term ubiquitous connectivity, in that it has, SIM slots, and they're obviously in the Intel side of the house and laptops for a while. We've had integrated SIM connectivity, but Qualcomm's platform is a much more native, if you will, hookup for SIMs and for mobile data networks. And so drop in a Verizon, AT&T SIM, it just works. And then once you have that set up, when you talk about a device that is designed for serious mobile compute, very stingy on battery life, absolutely sips power, multi-day battery life, and what I would call ubiquitous connectivity, it's really a different experience. And we've been looking at these. We looked at HP's NVX2 powered by a 4.5-watt Intel Core Series chip, Core Y Series chip. Not quite the same level of feel between those two. It just, the Qualcomm platform just has a sort of more natural connectivity and power, profile to it from a low power standpoint, that it really sort of completes that always connected PC sort of goal that's out there right now. And it's an interesting evolution of product that's coming out. Not just Qualcomm, Intel's driving that as well. And I think you'll see better iterations of Intel's version of this platform, or the vision, if you will. But what's interesting about it is it's Windows on ARM. And so there is a limitation. That HP NVX2 machine that we took a look at a few weeks ago, we actually mentioned that on the cast. That's, Intel x86, anything you install on it just works. You don't have to worry about it. The Windows on ARM platform, or Windows on Snapdragon in this case, you do have a limitation in terms of apps that are either on the Windows Store or, that were designed natively to run on Windows on ARM. So in this case, the OS, my earpiece keeps yanking down on me, excuse me, the OS, Windows, obviously Microsoft has built a version of Windows to, run natively on ARM. And they have some apps that have, like Office applications and whatnot that are also now native on ARM. And they've also brought forth an SDK to help developers develop new applications for Windows on ARM. But that's not every app currently. And so there are some apps, third-party apps that you'll go to install that either won't work or that have to run in emulation mode. That saps performance and a little bit of battery life in some cases. And so it's not fully native just yet. And so, there is a limitation there that you have to be aware of. But when you think about what people do on mobile compute platforms like this, 2-in-1 ultralights or what have you, very light notebooks, you're talking about web browsing, email, video consumption, maybe some video chat, Skype, what have you, audio consumption. And that's really that covers a wide swath of the mainstream marketplace for ultralight PCs. And so I think it's an interesting thing to watch. I think what's going to be really interesting is what comes next from Qualcomm, the Snapdragon 8XC platform, which will take up performance another notch. Actually, they claim they're going to compete with Intel's 15 watt now. So that's straight up Ultrabook platform, 15 watt Core Series chips. We'll see when that happens, when that product comes out. That's more like Q3 this year. But right now, Windows on ARM and these Snapdragon-powered PCs like the Lenovo Yoga C630, they're starting to mature nicely. And it was really for Rod, who does a lot of traveling, threw it in his bag for like 2 or 3 days. He didn't even plug in. And wherever he went, he had either a 4G connection or, a decent, robust wireless connection that would give him multi-megabit, downloads and uploads. And it was actually, a pretty satisfying experience for him. What are your thoughts about this machine, Marco? And I guess, would you make the jump at this point to Windows on ARM, or is it still baking, in your opinion?
I think the machine itself is cool. Lenovo makes great hardware. I love the look of their machines, for the form factor, great keyboard. I love the Yoga form factors. I love the flexibility of being able to use tent mode, stand mode, table mode, what have you. That's cool. Now, it's to the other question, would I switch to Windows on ARM? Personally, no. As a power user and someone who has to do video editing on the road and photo editing and need to have, I don't simply live inside Windows and Office. It probably wouldn't serve me well. Now, if your use case is I turn on my computer, I'm on the web, you know, use a bunch of web apps, and I use Microsoft Office, these machines are awesome, and they're sort of a game changer in terms of connectivity with that always on, always connected. You know, the other thing to consider is with that always on, always connected doesn't mean, you know, simply you turn it on and you have a connection. It means that, yes, but it also means when they're asleep, it continues to gather your emails and your notifications. So when you turn it on, everything is just there, like bang. You don't have to wait for anything. And there's really fast, you know, wake from sleep and all that kind of good stuff. So for if you're a power user and you use many applications over and above what's included with Windows and Office, it's a much tougher sell because those apps, if they install and run, they're going to run under emulation, which saps resources, affects performance, obviously. But all the native Windows stuff runs really well on these guys. So it's really going to depend on someone's use case, whether or not something like this fits their needs.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. It really does depend on the use case. Again, I think if you're looking for this machine to do office productivity, general light duty, mainstream, you know, laptop work, this will serve your needs. Yeah. Guys like us where we're crunching video on the road and stuff like that. Probably not the best platform for that kind of use case, content creation, what have you. I think you could probably get by with image editing, some light duty image editing. So if you're doing some publishing, whether it be online or otherwise, I think that's probably a fair use case. But yeah, set your expectations accordingly. And it's an interesting evolution. I think the next generation of Snapdragon processor platform that comes out, the 8XC, it'll be interesting to see how that competes with Intel, how far Microsoft has taken the developer ecosystem with the SDK and driven that. It will be an interesting, I think, landscape to look at, you know, in terms of these ultralight mobile PCs in around the Q3, Q4 timeframe this year. So rolling up to the holiday shopping season, there may be some pretty compelling offerings out there. We'll have to see. We've seen major brands behind it. I've seen Samsung, Lenovo, HP, Asus, basically all the top laptop manufacturers have at least dabbled in it. I haven't seen anything from Dell, the good friends at Dell. But, you know, there seems to be some inertia from big brands. And even though folks are probably, you know, trying to respect their Intel relationships, it's, you know, it seems like there's at least some adoption out there. So we'll have to watch it. It'll be fun, but that is an interesting product for sure. The Lenovo Yoga C630 retails for $699 with, this is at Best Buy, with a contract, a service contract for a carrier, a mobile carrier, a data plan, or $799, I think, without. So not too bad, you know, a reasonably priced machine and an interesting product to be sure to check on out, the Lenovo Yoga C630. I did drop the link in the chat so you guys can pull that up as well. All right, let's move on. Let's move back to the PC space. We'll shift gears again and talk about AMD's Radeon 7, what you guys have probably been teed up for. AMD Radeon 7, and we unboxed this thing and we also benchmarked the stuffing out of it. 7 nanometer Vega versus GeForce RTX. And we will give you our thoughts. So I will start by just saying that I don't know if you can see behind me, but over my shoulder there, this way, that way. Yeah, that way. You can see right on that stand. There it is. It's on its little lighted acrylic stand doing the thing. It's actually a beautiful card, and I unboxed it on video here at YouTube and stepped through the design of it. 3 axial fan design, a pair of 8-pin PCI Express power connectors, and I think it's 3 display port and an HDMI 2.0 port on the back IO plate. There I am unboxing it there. My grubby mitts getting all over the goodies that AMD packed in their box. And I should say that AMD does a really good job with presentation, really nice, glitzy sort of, trophy setup here that they, adorned to go with this, new graphics card. But yeah, that's the stand you're looking at there. But yeah, so Radeon 7, it is it's a well-built card, brushed aluminum, just highly sort of polished feel and look to it, just really premium. And, you know, looks are all that. Then you get the Radeon, little square Radeon illuminated cube in the top corner there, as always. Looks are all that and a bag of chips. What's performance like, Marco? Can you tell us?
hard to answer in a single sentence here, but performance is good. So when Dr. Lisa Su showed the card off at CES and AMD made their claims on performance, they said it would trade blows with a GeForce RTX 2080. So not the top of the line 2080 Ti, not the insane Titan RTX. So one notch down from the top in the enthusiast space, it would trade blows with the RTX 2080. Now, in my testing at 4K, the Radeon 7 did pull off a victory in the Vulcan-based Strange Brigade test. It basically tied in Far Cry 5, and it lost by a couple of frames per second in a few of the other tests. So you're talking maybe like a 5 to 8% difference in all the 4K benchmarks. If you go to the 1440p tests, the delta is a little larger because the Radeon 7's got this massive 1 terabyte per second of memory bandwidth. That bandwidth comes less into play at the lower resolutions. Delta was a little larger. It was a little more behind the 2080. And if you look at some like older titles, DX11 titles, it actually lost to the 2070 in some tests. Like the VR tests, it trailed the 2070, which is available for a few hundred dollars less. So performance is kind of all over the map. If you're a high-end gamer and you run at high resolutions, you want to crank everything up, it's a good card. It's good. Now, that said, right, $699 MSRP for this guy, you can find RTX 2080s at $699. Dollar for dollar, if all you care about is gaming, it's a tougher sell. Performance is competitive, but the RTX 2080 is a little faster, but the 2080 is also quieter, uses less power. It's more tweakable today. I think that's a software issue on AMD side, though. And then you have the promise of RTX technology in the future. Now, that said, this guy's got a 16 gig frame buffer, and it's an absolute beast in the compute tests. So if you're a content creator or you're an academic and you're going to leverage a GPU for whatever kind of math, especially, you know, double precision math, FP64 stuff, it's an absolute beast. Nothing can touch it. If you see the charts, it literally crushes everything by multiples, sometimes 5 or 6x, including like a 2080 Ti. So it's kind of a difficult performance profile. You can't really nail one group down where it's perfect. But it is competitive. At least it marks AMD's re-entrance into the competitive landscape at the high end of the GPU space. So that's the sort of short answer with a lot of words.
Yeah, it is a tough one to dissect, to be sure. I think you and I were both hoping for, I guess, a little bit more balanced performance, perhaps. And by that, I mean, we wish the power and thermal picture was a little better with respect to the performance. I think the performance levels, you know, where it's, you know, right on the tails of a 2080 and or beating it, or somewhere in between a 2070 and a 2080, you know, we could have expected a little more there, but yeah, it was pretty close to what we were expecting, what we were told. And, you know, for the price point, kind of where it needs to hit. I mean, honestly, I think, you know, what these days, what 2080s are coming down in price, right? It used to be that was a 2080 was a $799 card. That's not the case anymore, right?
Well, the non-founders, I think the base ones, I'm pretty sure it was that $699, but okay. There's very few of them. You can find them. Now, yeah, I have tons of theories on this card. So this is all speculation and rumor, all right?
Yeah.
For the last few months, a bunch of people had been saying that Vega 20 was not going to hit the consumer space, right? It was on the MI50 and MI60, and, you know, it's just too expensive to launch as a consumer card. This is speculation. Nobody said it to me. No confirmation from anybody. I think NVIDIA sort of ratcheting up prices at all the different brackets made AMD go, this chip would compete with a 2080. And now all of a sudden there's the potential for a little margin because NVIDIA shifted all those price brackets up. And that's why AMD made the decision to bring this out in the consumer space. I also think if you look at history, the Vega 64 came out and was competitive with 1080, but wasn't a clear win, yada, yada. But if you look at Vega 64 versus 1080 today versus launch, it basically wins across the board except for power. And you can get quiet cards from AMD's partners. Looking at Radeon 7, so this wasn't just a straight shrink of a Vega 64 down to 7 nanometer, right? There are some enhancements to the GPU, and AMD completely retooled how it handles thermal and frequency throttling with a whole new array of thermal sensors in the chip. It now checks for something that AMD calls junction temperature, which is basically an aggregate of a bunch of temperatures internal to the chip versus the single GPU temp of the past. So I think they kind of rushed it to get it out the door, and there is going to be some headroom to not only tweak power, but frequencies. I think they're going to be able to wring a little more performance over time, just like they did with Vega 64. I think that larger frame buffer is going to help longer term as games get more complex. And I think they'll be able to tweak that fan profile to make it a little more comfortable. The card was loud. So I think today, the battle against 2080, it's a real uphill battle for AMD. I think tomorrow the story is going to change. I'm speculating, but I would bet the farm that I'm right, and the landscape's going to look different in, say, 2 months. We'll see.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting situation to ponder. I think you're probably right with respect to, you know, the fact that this card obviously has monster compute performance. And when you think about, you know, it was initially targeted for the data center, for machine learning, for other workstation compute applications, you would see this card absolutely just dominating, doing very well in that space. And that certainly makes sense. I think interesting there when you talk about their AMD's pro workstation card lineup, this is going to affect that lineup nicely. It's going to drop into that lineup, offer some serious, value proposition for workstation professionals. But yeah, I think you're probably right. I think this card was, they saw the price points of NVIDIA's, product, it being a little bit more expensive than perhaps we all expected. And so they decided to strike with what they had and make a play at it. I think, what do you think about the potential that of availability for this product? Do we think there's going to be enough volume in the channel from the folks at AMD? They, of course, will tell you, yes, it's a volume card. But consumer volume is big volume.
Yeah, I've heard some concerning rumors that it's a very low count of cards, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was a low count to start. Like I said, this is an HPC / data center card that's been retooled, and it is very expensive. They are not going to want to end up with a bunch of unsold inventory, so they will be conservative, I believe, to test the waters. Yeah. I think people will be able to buy them because I don't think it's going to be an insane mad rush in the beginning. Anybody that's read the reviews, I think it was kind of universal across the board. Some of the sites were really high on it that, I'm not going to, whatever. But, I think it's not going to fly off shelves initially because the informed consumers that know what it is are probably going to play wait and see a little bit. Now,
yeah,
the other thing to consider is this isn't the full configuration of Vega 20. This is the slightly chopped down version from the MI50. Now, if everything I said comes to fruition, where there's some performance to be gotten from software, and there's some frequency headroom and room to play with power with a full configuration, which is a 4096 stream processor, 64 CU chip. The one in the Radeon 7 now is 60 CUs with 3840 stream processors. If they get, let's say AMD can get 5 to 10% more performance out of software, 3 to 5% more performance out of frequency and power, and then they come out with a 4096 stream processor version, if they do this, Now, all of a sudden, that's a card that will most likely clearly outpace the 2080. I don't think it catches 2080 Ti, but now they have a card. If they wanted to charge $1,000 for it, they could, assuming this all happens. So I don't know how to word it. It's kind of a funky launch. I think it was like, let's get this thing out the door and make a splash and you know, hope that people don't catch some of these issues. But
yeah.
This is an interesting play over 2019 until Navi comes.
I could almost feel the daggers coming out when you said $1,000 card. People would be like, no.
I mean, that stinks. I know nobody wants to spend $1,000, but if NVIDIA can get 1500 for a 2080 Ti and 2080s are going for 7 to 850.
Yeah.
And AMD has a card that has all of those compute and memory advantages plus outpaces 2080 in games. If a 4096 stream processor version comes, there's a case to be made. They could do it. So I'm just saying we're just chatting on a podcast. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's funny. I'm seeing 2080 Ti's. You're right. Ranging from 1200 to about 1400 for the Founders Edition, 1459, which is just, that's just crazy. I mean, we initially thought it was supposed to be targeted at 1299, but you can't find many of them for that. Well, here's a PNY GeForce RTX 2080 Ti at 1299. Yeah. So anyways, it's an interesting card. And the other thing is I hope they get the power situation in check a little bit better. And I think there is some optimization to be wrung out there. Fan noise seems excessive for what it is. I think the fact that if you undervolt the card or they have undervolt settings, suggested in the reviewer's guide to check out different, overclocking situations. That sort of speaks to the fact that there's still some optimization there. If they're saying here, take a look at undervolting the card. I think it could mature. What's interesting to me about this product as it relates competitively to NVIDIA's product is that I was in a Q&A one time with Jensen Huang at CES, actually with NVIDIA's CEO, Jensen Huang. And I asked him directly, I said, what do you think about the viability of HBM2 in a consumer card for NVIDIA? And he just shot it right down. He says, I love HBM2, love it in our workstation cards and in our machine learning data center cards. He says, too expensive. And that's what he said for their consumer cards. And he was very direct about it. It's like, gotcha. I didn't have to mince words with him at all. But I think that's probably probably biting AMD a little bit here in the butt is the cost of HBM2, how well it yields perhaps maybe as well. I don't know. But it's a very high-end memory interface. I mean, a terabyte per second of memory bandwidth. That's just crazy, crazy memory bandwidth. What do you think about, and that actually brings me to another question about this card. What do you think about this thing with crazy high levels of AA applications, resolutions and game settings rather, where memory bandwidth is key to performance? We looked at sort of our traditional setup. Let's turn on ultra settings, and then run it through the resolutions. Are there some corner cases where this thing, because of its memory bandwidth, is going to do really well in gaming? And I know we even looked at VR and it didn't seem to really stretch its legs there either. Are there areas where we can expect it to stretch its legs with that memory bandwidth?
So, if you were to have a multi-monitor setup and want nothing but the best quality, if you like to use those virtual super resolutions and get the ultimate quality, you can spill past an 8 gig frame buffer with some of the latest titles. Now, if you have a 4K display and you're not messing with anything but the native res and TAA, like Far Cry 5, for example, uses less than 5 gigs of VRAM at 4K ultra quality. Mm-hmm. Most of the other games we tested are sort of in the same range. That you can sort of tweak and tune things and use those higher reses and exceed an 8 gig frame buffer, in which case the 16 gig frame buffer or high bandwidth cache, what AMD likes to call it, would help. It's a much smaller corner case. There's also more content creation workloads where you may want more than 8 gigs, or, you know, HPC applications where you want more than 8 gigs. But again, that's another really small group of users. For a gaming card, for the vast majority, it's more of a future-proofing thing to, you know, lay the foundation for future games. That's why I'm saying, like, the landscape down the line might look different because of that extra memory, and because I think AMD's got some headroom. And it's interesting you bring up the undervolting, because, you know, overclocking was basically broken in this software. And I don't know if it's fair to say it's just the version of the press driver we got, or just the silicon lottery. My particular sample just wasn't really friendly for overclocking, but it seemed that lots of others had basically the same issues I did. And it just didn't make sense to me in the way that if you look at GPU temp, the traditional GPU temperature, the card was running like in the 70s under load for hours. The junction temperature was very high, you know, high 90s, hundreds, and that's what's being used now to throttle frequencies and voltage. I think AMD's being really conservative because they didn't have as much time as they wanted to get these cards out the door. So I think that whole algorithm has some wiggle room there. It's just my suspicion. I don't know. I just think there is going to be some wiggle room there. And, you know, if they can get some additional clock out of this thing, additional frequency out of this thing, you know, power was also pretty good. It was like 50 watts lower than a Vega 64 with much better performance. It was higher than a 2080, but not out of the realm. And now you mentioned the undervolting. What's cool with the undervolting, it didn't really affect performance. Performance stays level, but you can drop power like another 5, 8, 10%. So like there's wiggle room there. Yeah. It's just, that's the only way to kind of put it. There's room for AMD to play and optimize this card, especially if a board partner comes out with a custom card with even more robust power delivery and a bigger quiet cooler, who knows what this thing's going to do. You know, it could be really nice. This all has to shake out.
Yeah. You know, And the other thing that occurs to me is, why not a Radeon 7 8 gig? You know, I mean, can you depop that multi-chip module package? It's a chip and wire package.
If they want to do 8 gig, they have to build more with half density HBM2 if you want to keep that memory, the 4096 bit memory interface. So I don't think they built them because it was originally just going to be a data center card.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wonder. You know, that would obviously drive some cost down for sure. You've got 8 gig less frame buffer. It's a lot less frame buffer, and so drive some cost out of it. And maybe if you could keep, you know, 90% of the performance somehow at 1440p and under, that's a pretty cool card. If it's another, I don't know, $100 off or something like that, you know. Interesting. Yeah, interesting dynamic. I think there's, as you say, there's room to wiggle there in a lot of areas. We'll just have to see how it all pans out. I mean, it's a little weird, right? I mean, there's something weird there. And I guess that probably, you know, maybe speaks to, and again, we're speculating that maybe it speaks to AMD's sort of reactionary move. There was an opportunity they decided to strike. We know Dr. Su, CEO of AMD, is super aggressive as a CEO. I could see them making that decision to say, hey, let's roll this thing, man. We got CES coming up. We got to keynote it. Let's roll it, you know? So why not? Interesting stuff. Let's move on from Radeon 7 and stop by the site. Check out that full review. We've got copious pages of benchmarks. I will drop it into the chat right now. And Marco slaved over that sucker for hours. It's his War and Peace novel. Put his soul into it. so come check that out. It's a good review and tells you pretty much everything you need to know about Radeon 7. But let's talk about something from the good folks at Intel, Marco, that you checked out as well. The Intel Xeon W 3175X. Man, that's not very elegant now, is it? Intel Xeon W3175X, a supercharged 28-core Skylake processor, 28-core Skylake SP. 28 core chip. It is a Xeon. It is a Xeon sort of repurposed, re-engineered, and optimized for really workstation desktop platform versus server. And there it is there. That is a big honking chip. Monolithic 28 core die. It's not a chiplet thing like the folks at AMD do. What is this all about? And who is it for, Marco?
Yeah, this thing is nuts. So I have to apologize for my stream. I think my something's up my broadband. My quality has gone into the toilet. Before I answer your question on the Xeon, a couple of things from the chat. Orion, yeah. Blackhawk, nice to have you with us. Nathan, no, not a blower style fan. It is a triple axial fan. It can vent basically out of three sides. But it's not an axial fan. It's not a blower fan pumping out of the case. Most of the heat will stay inside the case. Okay, now back to the Xeon. This is actually a good segue because this is exactly Intel did with this Xeon what I'm speculating AMD can do with Radeon 7. So yes, the Xeon W3175X is essentially a Xeon Platinum 8180, right? The Xeon Scalable architecture. It's Skylake SP. It's the 28-core monolithic, 28-core 56-thread Xeon, but same chip, same silicon. They are binned, you know, they are binned so that Intel can get higher frequencies. But what Intel did was unlock it so you can overclock it. They had their motherboard partners, ASUS and Gigabyte initially. It's probably just going to be ASUS and Gigabyte, built motherboards with insanely robust power delivery, 32-phase power circuitry on the ASUS Mobius motherboard that we used for testing. And they took this 28-core chip and they cranked up the clocks to insane levels for a monolithic 14-nanometer CPU, base clock of 3.1, boost clock of 4.3, with, you know, six-channel memory architecture. And what you end up with, even though it doesn't have as many cores as AMD's 32-core Threadripper 2990WX, you end up with insane multi-thread performance because of the high clocks. So it basically, I think it won like 90% of the multi-threaded benchmarks, maybe more. Might have been all of them. I have to go look at all the graphs. Yeah. With the better single-thread performance, Intel's architectures still have better single-thread than AMD. And because it's monolithic and you don't have to deal with all these different memory domains, it's just a big, giant, massive memory controller, you don't have to deal with any of those weird compatibility issues that Threadripper WX series has because there are compute dies without memory attached. So all in all, it's just a monstrous beast of a multi-threaded processor targeted at people with insane budgets and, you know, content creators that are running workloads that will leverage all of these compute resources. So it's, this is not, if you're a gamer and you only game, you have to be nuts to spend this kind of money for a chip like this. You know, if you're filthy rich and you want to buy a few, hey man, more power to you, but it doesn't make sense if you're just a gamer, right?
Right.
This is for those content creation workloads, those design professionals, you know, doing tons of video editing where you're going to use all of these resources, then it's simply the fastest desktop platform money can buy today.
Yeah. 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 No, it is a crazy, crazy powerful chip. And yeah, you have to have the budget to be able to justify it and the use case, the workload to be able to justify it. I think certainly workstation professionals, content creation professionals, where you're grinding on something for hours on end, you know, to process something, you know, with highly threaded apps, you know, certainly video editing is one of those kind of situations where you're gonna tax all those threads. We ran certainly all the standard benchmarks. Cinebench was in there. Rendering, you know, 3D rendering, Blender, Cinema 4D, these professional rendering applications, those are going to make use of this kind of horsepower. Yeah, it is a crazy fast chip. How did you feel? So $3,000, right?
Yes.
For the performance, what do you think about this chip versus you know, let's just take the next step down to the Threadripper 2990WX. For the average workstation professional, that actually justifies a $1,500 to $3,000 CPU. Well, how about that? That matchup there.
So it's a 73% higher price for a few percentage points in performance. So strictly in terms of price for performance, very difficult to justify. But it's difficult to justify, right? It's a $3,000 desktop processor. That's no joke. But the advantages of the Intel architecture being monolithic and not having to deal with those software issues, there's something to be said there. You know, like on the AMD side, what's cool is you have a lot of flexibility with the software to say, okay, you know, this workload doesn't like the memory configuration. I can switch it in software, a quick reboot, and that's fixed. But you just don't have to deal with that stuff at all, you know, on the AMD side. There's value in that, right? There's value in the better single thread just tooling around on the desktop. Now, any modern PC is going to be fine on the desktop too, but I'm just saying that there is a technical advantage there.
Yeah.
It's just so expensive. $3,000, man, it's pricey. Now, back to the point you make, I think a content creation professional that's already spending many thousands on a workstation probably would go for it and not bat an eye. Because if you look at it versus a competitive Xeon, it's a freaking bargain. You know, the Xeons are many thousands just for the chip. So Intel is in that position where they know they have the fastest chip, so they're going to charge a premium versus the competition strictly in terms of the numbers. Yeah, it's hard to justify that premium, but in the entire landscape versus Intel's premium Xeons, it's cheap. So
Well,
really, it's going to depend on your use case.
So then you go to system complexity, right? I mean, obviously, so here's an interesting dynamic as well, right? From what I gathered, this chip isn't coming out for the DIY system builder anytime soon. It's really something that's available for system integrators that will, you know, or boutique guys that will build systems with this chip. You're not going to find this thing. I mean, you'll probably find it in the channel, you know, and you'll find those motherboards in the channel as well, Asus and Gigabyte. But for all intents and purposes, this is really a system integrator play initially, right? Is that's fair, right?
So it's only system integrators for now. And I haven't heard that they're going to sell it separately, but it will probably show up at some point. Yeah.
You would think it would get out there. And so you've got a custom motherboard, you know, huge gargantuan motherboard that takes a custom, essentially a workstation chassis to support it. Cooling is another thing too, right? When you talk about Threadripper, even the 2990WX, that's air cooled. This thing is liquid cooled only, right?
Yes, I don't think anybody makes an air. Like, if somebody made an adapter for the Threadripper cooler for this thing, it would probably work. But I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is a hugely important thing with this chip. Yeah. Now, Intel sent so the motherboards that are out there use the EEB form factor. They will not fit in standard ATX towers, right? There are some really nice EEB compatible cases at a wide range of prices. So it's not like there's no cool cases to choose from if by some chance you're able to build your own. So there are some nice cases out there. But here's the thing that stuck with me. Intel assembled the system that we tested. It came assembled from Intel. I took care of the software side of the equation, but the physical assembly came from Intel, and it had a brand new Asetek 360 millimeter liquid cooled setup. So, you know, 320 millimeter fans on a 360 millimeter radiator, plus there was an additional 5 case fans, plus the PSU fan, plus the GPU fan. So the system was super loud. There was no other way to say it. I mean, like server loud.
Yeah. You
know, like a 2U server with those crazy blowers loud. Even with that setup, you could very easily, so at stock speeds, right, it ran cool. The CPU was like in the high 70s, nothing to be concerned about. The slightest overclock, right, temperatures would shoot up to 100 C. Now the chip doesn't throttle; it throttles at a higher point than the traditional desktop chip, so that temperature isn't an issue. But that kind of cooling was required just to even get it to that point. Whereas if I just unplugged that Intel rig, my Threadripper system has an off-the-shelf thermal take, also a 360 millimeter radiator. Two case fans. I test everything in a system as somebody, you know, assembling it would.
Yeah.
Dead silent. You don't even hear it. The system is dead silent and it works perfectly fine. I think if you were to choose fans, you know, strategically and use maybe a better thermal interface material and perhaps even a bigger radiator, you can make a system like this tolerable. But the system that was sent for testing, I personally could not work on it. It's just too loud. Like you literally would have to wear noise canceling headphones to work at your desk. Wow. So that's a concern. And that was just a fact of the system that was sent here.
Yeah.
Something else to consider.
Yeah. 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 It seems like there should be some cooling optimization going on there as well. One of the folks in the chat dropped in liquid nitrogen. I think that's a little bit too exotic, but Blackhawk says liquid nitrogen. That's, you know, man, you're obviously pushing the limits of silicon integration here, where you talk about a 28 core single monolithic chip, memory controller, all of that on board. It is a big honking die and obviously takes some serious, you know, it's a server chip, you know, repurposed in a desktop, and it takes server class cooling. So wild stuff. It just makes me wonder, you know, obviously Intel's getting to the 10 nanometer process, and that's going to drive cooling and power optimization again. We're not there yet with Skylake XP. I mean, how old is that architecture? 2-3 years, something like that.
And the 2017. Yeah. You know, and speaking of power, just to give some context, stock, no overclocking. Under load, the 2990 WX 32 core chip, the system pulled 396 watts. This guy pulled 524. Now, when I overclocked it with just this, the liquid cooling, like nothing insane. I got it to 4.5 gigahertz all core boost, which is nuts for this chip. 767 watts with a single 1080 in there.
Dang.
That's some juice, man. You know,
it's some juice. What's the fab process here is 14 nanometer, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So it really, that's what you're talking about with this platform is that it needs to migrate to next generation silicon architecture, next generation process geometry for Intel. It needs to get there. And then, you know, we're going to have some serious competition, I think, for, you know, from a power and performance and price performance standpoint versus AMD. You know, AMD has basically a hybrid architecture. Was it Zen 2 is 7 nanometer, right? And so coming up, and so they're epic. They're big many core server chips, going to be 7 nanometer. I think the first Threadripper or even second generation Threadripper is 10 nanometer, right? Right?
No, there's no 12.
Still, 12, I mean, 12.
Technically 14, but
And that chiplet design that allows them, you know, better efficiency for cooling and power. So yeah, man, it's a fascinating time, and Intel's playing a little bit of catch up on the process side of things, which is, that's not usually the dynamic. They're usually murdering people with process, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So cool stuff. And the Intel Xeon W3175X, check that out, the review. Marco's been a review machine lately. Thank you, Marco.
You're welcome. And I am so loaded up. I'm going to try to crank out 3 next week. We'll see. All the testing is done. All the testing is done for my next 3. I have to do picks and layout and writing. Sounds easy. Yeah. It's not.
I've got some stuff landing in myself. I'll start getting busy. I do a lot of the biz dev stuff here and the editorial side of things. But I've got some stuff coming in. I've got some interesting stuff coming in. I've got Dell's Area 51M gaming laptop on the way. I've got probably some baubles coming in from Samsung, I do believe, when I visit them shortly. And maybe, who knows, excuse me, some other manufacturers that'll be announcing at Mobile World Congress. I'm sure LG's been making some rumblings. We'll find out. But so maybe some Snapdragon 855 in the mix. Who knows? That'd be interesting. I think it's that close. Just rumors, speculation, just tea leaves that we're reading right now that's been in the news. So I'm not spilling any NDA information there. But stick around hothardware.com for all the news and reviews in the days ahead, and lots of different stuff coming. Marco, before we sign off, do you have any gems of wisdom for the folks from what you've been immersed in lately?
Just a couple of things. One, don't take any wooden nickels. Two, no matter how good the soap smells, never come out of the bathroom smelling your fingers. And three,
good point.
And three, read all of our reviews before you spend money on any computer hardware. There you go.
There you go. That last one was a real good one. Yeah. No, although the smell on the fingers thing, that's just sound advice too. I totally agree with you.
Yes. There. No matter how good the soap smells, do not do that.
Beautiful stuff. Well, hey, stop on by hothardware.com where you can find us on the web, twitter.com/hothardware where you can tweet to us, youtube.com/hothardware or hothardware vids. G Plus is going away. You can find us on MeWe, believe it or not. We even got that. We've got an Instagram. We'll Insta ya and all that good stuff. And stick with us in the weeks ahead. We got more coming. And thanks for stopping by.